Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum. We record talks all over the Puget Sound region, from uber-famous intellectuals to lesser-knowns, from soldiers to urban farmers, humorists to rocket scientists. I'm John O'Brien. Tonight we bring you a talk by artist and Iraq War veteran Sean Davis. When Davis graduated from Oregon's Sweet Home High School in 1991, he wanted to see the world. He considered joining the Peace Corps, but with no plans for college, he wasn't eligible. Unhappy with his grocery store job, Davis finally did what he'd determined not to do. He joined the Army. That began a life-changing series of consequences for Davis. He did travel the world, finding purpose and great friendship amidst the craziness and turmoil, until he couldn't anymore. Stay tuned. It's a harrowing story of war and the struggle to survive it, told with heart. Sean Davis is the author of The Wax Bullet War, Chronicles of a Soldier and Artist. He spoke at Ravenna's Third Place Books on August 6th, 2014. Thanks to Anna Tatashev for this recording. Please be advised, the following program contains some language and situations of an adult nature.
That was awesome. Thanks. Thank you. You guys are supposed to clap twice as hard to let the radio know that there's a lot of people here. I should have helped you. My name's Sean Davis. I grew up in Blue River, Oregon, Mackenzie Bridge, Oregon. It's a small little logging town. And when I graduated high school, I decided I would never join the military because 70% of my graduating class joined the military. And it took 2 hours of... two years of working at the Safeway Deli, and I'm like, yeah, I'm going to join the military. And so I did. And I was regular Army for almost 7 years. I went to Hawaii, and then in the middle of Hawaii, I went to Haiti during the revolution. And I'll tell you a little story about Haiti in 1995. I was a private over there. And our first time is like, we hadn't done anything warlike in a long time. And so Haiti came and all the officers were like, I need to put this on my resume. And so we went there and they went crazy. But what they forgot was our cultural awareness presentation was a 15-minute PowerPoint that, and that 70% of it was genitalia engorged with infection, some kind of a disease. And they were trying to say, like, you know, if you touch any of the natives there, this is what's going to happen to you. So they had the big slideshow of all this stuff. No history of the place, no language training, nothing about the people at all. And I was a 19-year-old kid that didn't know anything except for the hills of Oregon. And it really scared the hell out of me. I was terrified. I didn't want to touch them. And then one day... we had a lot of different missions, but one of our missions was to guard President Aristide's presidential palace. And it only took a couple weeks before they knew that we had a medic. And there was no electricity out there, no hospitals out there. And so they came with us. You know, this guy came with a screwdriver in his neck or a machete wound, you know, and like, hey, fix us. And one day, a woman, a big pregnant woman, comes in and squats between two burnt out cars and just has a baby in the gutter, you know. And we run out there and we're all, you know, setting up. And the medic, this has just happened instantly, right? And so without even putting his gloves on, he's grabbing this baby to deliver it. And the only thing I can think of is inflamed genitalia. This guy's in trouble. And that was, so I got out in 99. that it'll make more sense later. I'll tell that story first. I got out in January of 1999, and I decided I was in Germany at the time. I flew from Germany to Pensacola, Florida, and I drove all the way across the United States to Los Angeles to become a screenwriter because I thought, you know, maybe it'd be easy or whatever. And it only took 3 months living in L.A. I'm like, I'm going back to Portland. This place is horrible. Nothing against it. I just wasn't used to it, right? And so I got up to Portland, and I went to art school up there. I always wanted to be an artist. That was my whole dream, you know. And I was in art school for a while. Met a girl. We broke up. I dropped out of art school. I was in the Oregon Department of Transportation's incident response. So what I did is I drove around in circles until I, you know, ran out of gas just about. And I was looking for roadkill and looking for incidents to respond to. And it was just a horrible existence for me. And so what I did is the day after September 11th, I joined the Oregon National Guard. And the Oregon National Guard, I was thinking, well, I want to do my part. I want a little bit of adventure, but I don't want that regular Army stuff anymore. And the most they'll have me do is guard the airport or maybe the chemical depot, Umatilla, the chemical depot. And then a year and a half later, I was at war. And it was a weird, we were one of the first National Guard units that they sent, you know. And so they had us do a year train up to make sure we didn't shoot ourselves in the foot or we weren't weekend warriors or whatever that whole stigma was. And so we did a train up at home and then a 5-month train up at Fort Hood and then a month in Louisiana, which I would eventually come back to during Hurricane Katrina to help out. But I'm trying to segue into this first story that I'm going to read. And it's so I grew up in the 80s and I had Stallone and Schwarzenegger tell me how cool war was, you know. And so when I was finally going to end up going to war, whether it was my choice or not, I had a certain idea what it was supposed to be like, you know. I remember the Chuck Norris, you know, and all those great movies. And so I'm going to tell you how it really was. So this chapter is called Starving in the Belly of a Whale. You know, I love Tom Waits. It's a Tom Waits song. A single-file line of soldiers stretched from the mouth of the civilian airline 747 down to the stair car, across the tarmac of Portland International Airport, and almost all the way back to the real world. The ground crew loaded our A and B bags into the belly of the plane, and we lugged our rucks and our rifles as carry-ons. I shifted my shoulders against the weight and looked at the overcast sky, fully aware that I would miss the clouds, even in threatening papier-mâché-looking ones overhead. The officers walked around outside of the line with an elevated sense of privilege, but sooner or later they were going to get on too. They made sure no one smoked while waiting in line to get on the plane that would take us to the other side of the world to kill people we've never met because smoking is illegal at the airport. The line moved slowly because one of the majors in the battalion staff stood in the door of the plane, checking to make sure the firing pins had been removed from each weapon. They wanted to make sure that none of us knuckleheads shot a hole in the side of Omni Air's pretty plane. I saw Captain Charbonneau taking small but quick steps towards Lieutenant Caius while I watched them trade salutes and talk. An unsettling feeling came over me, one that I really couldn't put a finger on. The line moved another few feet, but I couldn't keep my eyes off of them. They weren't upset, and whatever they were talking about seemed trivial. In fact, that was the problem. Everything was trivial, and suddenly it made sense. I was upset because this wasn't how going to war was supposed to be. I wanted Patton. I wanted Teddy Roosevelt. Hell, I would have taken Schwarzkopf. I wanted my chance to be picked by the Valkyries and taken to Valhalla. I wanted to rush in at high tide and storm the fortified beachhead. I wanted to come in hot, flying low in a Huey with a door gunner with a handlebar mustache lighting up the countryside. And instead, I shuffled in line, waiting my turn to ride coach into the combat zone, hoping that the in-flight movie wasn't a rom-com. The captain walked smartly away, and Lieutenant Caius called for the squad leaders and the platoon sergeant, and I didn't mind the leadership meeting because it meant that I can step out of line with a sense of elevated privilege. The lieutenant told us that a couple of the Arkansas boys were hit and one was killed. They had left 2 weeks before we did, and an IED, or an improvised explosive device, hit one of their convoys on the way up, and the engines on the 747 roared to life, and I couldn't hear the rest of his speech, so I stood there, nodding appropriately. 14 hours later, the pilot announced our descent into Kuwait City, Kuwait, local time 1 a.m., 10 hours into the future for those of us in the U.S. The temperature was an uncharacteristically cool 74 degrees Fahrenheit. And we landed, and the muffled voice of the colonel came over the cabin intercom, and the first order I received in a combat zone was to remain seated until the plane came to a full and complete stop. I leaned over to look out the window, trying to catch a glimpse of something exotic, like an oasis or a camel, but I only saw the yellow striped cement of any airport runway. The normalcy of it all was driving me mad. The plane took 15 very dull minutes to come to a stop, and when it did, the seatbelt sign went off with a ding. And I got my rucksack from the overhead bin, slung my rifle over my shoulder, and stood in the aisle thinking that maybe, when I got off the plane, the war stuff would start happening. And the line poured out the door, and I stepped into the air without any taste of trees in it. I had to smack my tongue a few times before I realized that the freshness I was accustomed to had been replaced by a tinge of mutton and salty dirt. A battalion staff major, armed with only a clipboard, directed each company to the designated waiting areas under a generated field light. And I wanted to finally experience this part of the world, but I was disappointed to find everything, except for the air, was the same. The waiting, the sitting, the complaining, the smoking, the complete lack of knowledge regarding what the hell any of us were doing. But when Sergeant First Class Schofield called for the squad leaders, the intensity in his eyes burned into us the seriousness of our situation. However familiar things seemed, we were indeed in a combat zone, and there was work to be done. And the cherry of his marble red lit up, and he breathed in and started his speech, and the smoke still floating in his mouth. The two-star general and the 2-7 Cav are fighting over us to be their QRF, and either way it goes, this means Bravo Company is going to be separated from the rest of the battalion. We're going to be asked to do some serious stuff. Make sure none of your boys left any of their stuff on the airplane in case you have all the information. And make sure you have all the information on each soldier in case the worst happens. We all said, yes, Sergeant. And we started to disperse, and he called after us. And make sure that all their firing pins are back in their weapons. Sorry, there's a little jar there at the end because I'm trying to not cuss. And that's pretty much all we did over there as infantrymen. These guys can attest. So this is a special reading because this is the first time ever that I actually have one of the characters in my book at it. There's Matt Zedwick. He's the one that pulled me out of the wreckage in this. I don't think I'm going to read that scene because I always start crying when I do. But he got the first Silver Star of any Oregonian since World War II for the stuff he did over there. And I was talking about a little bit about our squad, you know, including the guy that replaced me as squad leader. We had 6 Purple Hearts, a Silver Star, 3 Bronze Stars, and a bunch of other awards. And plus, after I left for the Battle of Najaf, these guys won the Presidential Unit Citation, which is the same award that they gave SEAL Team 6 for killing Osama bin Laden, same award that they gave the 101st for storming the beaches in World War II. So it's a really big deal. We did a lot of stuff.
Coming up, why Sean Davis called his Iraq War memoir the Wax Bullet War. We'll be back after a quick break. For KUOW 94.9 Seattle and Speakers Forum, I'm John O'Brien. Welcome back to Speakers Forum on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Today we're featuring a talk by author and Iraq War veteran Sean Davis. Davis has a healthy respect for the horrible and humorous aspects of war. Coming up, lack of sleep, fear, adrenaline, and laughter's release.
The next thing I'm going to read is how busy we were while we were over there. But before then, you know, I'm going to talk about the name of the Wax Bullet War. And you guys are going to, they'll laugh too. So when you first get into country, you don't land straight into Iraq. We landed in Kuwait, and you stay there for 30 days because your body is acclimatizing to the heat. And you get there, and they bus you to this place. It's a big camp in the middle of nowhere, so it's just flat as far as you can see, as far as the eye can see. And not just sand. I mean, this is packed down stuff, just flat. And right in the middle of it is this camp, this oasis. And we have Burger King. We have green bean coffee. We have Subway sandwiches. We have a movie theater. We have a workout gym. And I got to thank you guys because you paid for it, right? It was I seriously relate it to colonizing Mars. I mean, it was insane. And they have lights going on all the time, running water, and it's all generated, fuel generator, diesel. And it's insane. I was like, wow, I didn't think we needed that stuff. Somebody did. And and we used it. So I think I ate a Big Mac over there, so I'm guilty too. But what you do after like the first week or so, we're drilling all the time, you know, because we were pretty, our platoon sergeant just kept us drilling. And what you do is we went out into this range in the middle of nowhere. And this is really where I saw my first wild camel, right out the back of the Dusenhof. And we drive for about 20 minutes and we get to this range, brand new range. And we even have a shoot house, which is made out of brand new tires, you know. Again, you guys paid for it. And at this range, these two Navy SEALs are just laughing it up. They're like, hey, when you guys get out, you get to be contractors, you get paid four times as much. You can go home in 3 months. They were like, yeah, but we really want our war right now, so stop talking. But at any rate, so what they did was you have your M4 and you shotgun it. You take the bolt, you fold it in half, and then inside of it is the bolt. And inside the bolt is the firing pin, and that's what strikes the round. That's what shoots it. And so we all have to, we're instructed to take all of our bolts out, and they give us new bolts. And these bolts fire blue wax bullets. And so we're putting it back in, and they give us this tub of blue wax bullets. You know, I'm not a genius or anything, but you know, firing blue wax bullets in 120-degree heat, usually it just didn't work. And so we're trying to make our weapons more accurate. And it's like click, click, you know, splat, click, splat, and it's just not working at all. And I went to our lieutenant, who Kai isn't here, but his name's Kent, and I said, why don't they give us real bullets? I remember he sat up, and I'll censor this, but his answer is a quote: "Because Army logistics is full of I don't know how to waffles, I guess is what it would be." Sergeant Davis, and I said, "All right, sir. Well, what would happen if we got him?" He's like, "Well, we'd probably shoot ourselves, or imagine what would happen if we actually snuck him into combat, you know." And so that became, for, I didn't pick the name of this, the publishers did. And that became like a metaphor for the war for them, you know. I had a different metaphor in mind, but yeah. So our first 30 days that we were there, we had at least 34 combat missions. We were just going because we went to a place called Al-Taji, but the base was called Al-Taji. And it was where Saddam, it was an Air Force base, but it was also a place where they fixed tanks, the biggest tank maintenance place. And when we got our trucks, we call them the cardboard coffins, we didn't get up armored trucks at first. We got trucks that had, imagine trucks that are flatbed, and then imagine a couple 2x4s or 4x4s sticking in each post, and then some plywood running around. You had two layers of plywood, one on the inside, one on the outside, and inside those plywood layers you had sandbags, hoping that that would stop something, right? And forgetting the fact that plywood's flammable. And yeah, it didn't stop anything. So we were pulling parts off of those tanks pretty quickly to stick in there. And but, you know, whoever thought up, again, they're called hardened vehicles. Whoever thought those up didn't take into account the weight. And so we were replacing the suspension like every couple weeks. It was insane. Don't get me started. But it sounds like I'm just complaining about stuff. You know, we had fun, too. And I get in trouble for saying that. I was on NPR and I said, I was with Phil Clay. It wasn't about me. It was about Phil Clay, and he wrote this book called Redeployment. And but I got interviewed too, and I said, you know, you're forgetting about the fun parts of war. And right away we get callers and emailers like, I can't believe he said the fun parts of war. But honestly, yeah, it's horrible. You know, a good friend of ours was killed. It's horrible. We lost three guys in our company. Horrible. And I completely advocate about not ever going to war again. But when you're there and you're leading men in combat, it is something. Wow. You know, that adrenaline is amazing. Yeah, I'm going to read about that right now. And then after this, maybe you guys have some questions because maybe it's a little controversial. I don't know. I'll read this right now. And this chapter is, be polite, be professional, and be prepared to kill everyone you meet. And that's a quote from Chesty, some Marine general, but we said it a lot. We lived it. Throughout our first 30 days in country, we were sent to more than 30 combat missions. Taji was right in the middle of what some people call the Sunni Triangle, and this meant that we operated in an area where people had been big supporters of Saddam. In fact, he had been captured just months before, about 90 miles north of Taji. Before we borrowed it, Camp Cook was called Al-Taji Airfield, and it was an Iraqi Republican Guard base suspected to manufacture chemical weapons. And it was also Saddam's biggest tank maintenance facility. And the entire northwest corner of the camp was filled with a tank graveyard, rows and rows of tanks, bought from all over the world, rusted right there in the corner of our base, hundreds of them, more than you'd probably see anywhere else in the world. And every time we left for patrol through the north gate, I read the new graffiti. Some U.S. soldier would write his sweetheart's name or the name of his hometown in spray paint and pose next to the tank for a picture home. And I thought about doing it myself, but we never had time. Our new commander ran us ragged because we were the only infantry unit on base, and we ran on continuous ops for the majority of that first month and patrolled around the clock. Not only were we patrolling the roads and the fields around the base, we also had to guard a bridge about 10 miles south of Taji to keep it from getting blown up. It was our main supply route. On top of all this, we had our QRF missions coming in from the general, and when he needed us, we'd jump on helicopters and flew down to the green zone or wherever else. QRF is a quick reaction force, and we're kind of like the 911. Something would happen, we'd jump on the helicopters and fly. The daily patrols were conducted in triple-digit heat while wearing at least 60 pounds of gear, on no more than 2 hours of sleep at one time, and on no more than six hours of sleep over a single 24-hour period. And this seemed impossible. But we did it for almost 2 months straight. How? It was fear. Without fear, there would have been no adrenaline, and we lived on adrenaline. It was the perfect drug, and with it, I felt unstoppable. I can carry more weight, move faster, jump higher. My senses were in overdrive. I saw farther and clearer. I heard more than I thought possible, and I had greater control over my motor functions. I was able to process information and make decisions faster. I was superhuman. And it wasn't uncommon to leave for a patrol and drive by an area hit by a mortar barrage. The base had a fire engine and an ambulance, like you see in traffic accidents here at home. But the writing on the side is full of Arabic squiggles and dots. And when we drive by these scenes of devastation, I couldn't help but look over at the flashing lights. And sometimes I can hear the injured soldiers screaming. Our job was to hunt the holes, killing our troops. And each day that went by without us finding them, more and more people died. And heading out on the job meant filling your chest with as much fear and anger as you could, because that's what kept you going, and that's what motivated you, and that's what kept the adrenaline pumping. But being at war meant something else, too. It meant finding humor in as many places as possible. Laughter was a release, a way to clear out all that fear and hate when you didn't need it anymore, like an exhaust system. And sure, gallows humor, but the ironies of life became a bit more obvious as well. For example, after a month or so, the general sent the military police out to patrol the base and pull over speeders. Their job was to pull over vehicles traveling over 15 miles an hour on base because those drivers were being unsafe and kicking up too much dust in a combat zone. And they tried to pull us over once, but we found that if we just ignored them and kept driving out the gate, they would not follow. There was another irony that was not lost on me. It was almost 3 years after 9/11, and I was over 7,000 miles from where I started, and I was driving in circles on a highway looking for roadkill and responding to incidents. Though there were a few big differences, of course, in Iraq, some people shot at me while we drove, and the roadkill was potentially packed with high explosives, but hey, at least I was making a few dollars more an hour. Yeah, these guys are laughing because they are both there. They remember. We got Jeremy Turner and Matthew Zedwick back there. And Matthew Zedwick's in the book as Baldwin. I named you Baldwin because, well, Balder. Balder is that the brave. Balder the brave, you know, is Thor's buddy. So I thought you're a brave dude. So I didn't name Jeremy because he was another platoon. But we were together before. We went to Stonehenge together. Remember that? That was awesome. All right. So I'm not sure what part I'm going to read next. I had a couple parts in mind, but I'll just tell a story. Unless you guys have some questions about anything. You have any questions?
From what I've read about the newest version of militancy over in between Syria and Iraq, after hearing some editorializing about what it's like, they must be having jolly good fun themselves.
Right? Well, I don't, if they like war, I don't know. I don't want to answer that question.
I mean, it's they're taking it to a real medieval level. But
well, a lot of people do ask me like how I feel about leaving Iraq, and then ISIS coming in and taking back and upsetting everything that we set up, and I'm not mad about it at all. I mean, I think we all knew it was going to happen, The first story that I wrote in this book a couple years ago was called The Kid, and that was, so we're driving up in a convoy, and we're the QRF again for the convoy. You have QRFs for everything, and a big rig blows a tire, pulls over, and my squad is a QRF, so we have to stay with this big rig while the rest of the chalk leaves. And we knock on the door, and these the maintenance guys do not want to come out of their truck. This is war. We just got into Iraq. And I'm like, all right, fine, we'll just wait here. We'll call for another wrecker. They'll come and change the tire. And we're waiting there, and all of a sudden there's these four kids, and they come out of nowhere. And you can't see anything. It's flat for as far as you can see. And I thought, I was like, is there a tunnel system, or what's going on here? And yeah, I think it was the mirage effect. You couldn't see past a certain point, right? But I just ignored them. And my gunner, Peter Brady, that was his real name. I asked him once, why did your parents call you Peter Brady? He's like, well, they're going to name me John, but I thought people would make fun of me because John's another name for bathroom. I'm like, good choice. Anyway, he trades a cigarette for a Saddam bill, and after that, the bartering just goes, right? And they're just, and then I look back, and there's 20 kids, and I'm like, oh my, and Eric is driving, and Z's in the back, and I'm like, I'm just out of this. I'm gonna go take a leak and pretend it's not happening. Hopefully, the wrecker will get here, and I come back, and there's 50 kids around us, and I'm like, where are they coming from? And so, at the beginning, those four kids, the oldest, it was a 15-year-old, I would say two 10 or 12-year-olds, and then a 4-year-old child. And so there's four of them, and they're asking for water, food and water, food and water. And we can't give them anything because, we just got orders not to give them anything because it's just this thing, stray dog effect type of thing. But they're there, and they're not listening to me. I'm telling them, Lulubiet, go home, but they're not listening. And so I go to the oldest kid, the 15-year-old, and I tell him, I'm like, if you get rid of all these other kids, we'll give you food and water. And he acted like he was waiting for me to say that. And all of a sudden, him and the two 12-year-olds, just start beating the crap at all. It looked like a riot at an orphanage. It was horrible. I'm like, oh, I felt guilty. They're just punching bloody noses and kicking them in the stomach. But after 2 minutes, they're all gone. And so we just have the four kids there. And so I take one bottle of water, 32-ounce bottle of water, and one MRE and give it to the 15-year-old. I do that for the 12-year-old, and then to the 4-year-old. And as soon as I give it to the 4-year-old, the kid next to him takes it from the 4-year-old. And I'm like, hey, give that back. You can't do that. And he's staring at me, and I turn to the 15-year-old to tell your buddy to give it back. And as soon as I break eye contact, he takes off running. And so the next kid runs after him, and he tackles him. I'm like, good, he's going to get the food and water back for this 4-year-old. No, he grabs it all and takes off running. And so the 15-year-old grabs him. And pretty soon the 15-year-old has it all and just takes off. And the two 12-year-olds are like, well, they're not going to give us any more, so, we're taking off too. And then my first hour in Iraq, and I turn, I got a 4-year-old kid right here, and I don't know what the heck to do with him. And, and the wrecker comes, and they change the tire, and the big rig takes off, And my squad is still there, you know. And you know, my driver Eric, he had the biggest heart, and he's like, "Sean, we got to take him with us, man." I'm like, "What?" And then my Bravo team leader, Matt McCreary, he's like, "We got to get the hell out of here. Why do these people live in this, you know, crap hole place?" And so I got these two sides, and I give the kids some food, and pretty soon the radio calls like, "Where are you guys at? We got to go." And Eric's like, "We got to take them with us." I'm like, "Eric, are you going to raise them between missions, man?" You know, and I'm like, "What are you going to do? You know, start a kindergarten." And Matt's like, "We got to go. We got to go." And I give the kids some Skittles, and I hear both sides, "We got to go. We got to keep them. We got to go." And they're like, "Everybody shut the hell up. No one is going anywhere until this kid finishes his Skittles." That was it. And then, you know, I was thinking. And at the end, we just gave that kid a bunch of as much food and water as he can carry. And McCreary is like, "Hey, if you know they're just going to come and beat him up and take it from him," I'm like, "Yeah, I hope so, because then he can follow them wherever the, you know, wherever they live or whatever, you know." And so that I wrote that story first because to me, that was my metaphor for the entire war, you know. It's like, we're there, we're trying to help. I mean, I know guys now, because I work a lot with veterans, and I know lieutenant colonels, I know all kinds of guys in the infrastructure. We built them 12 police stations in one region, and we built them from scratch. And I don't know why, but we used New Hampshire Police Department as a model, right? And the first thing they did when they came in to see these police stations, they're like, "Where's the bakery?" We're like, "What? Where's the bakery? Our police stations have bakeries." I'm like, "Wow, okay, well, get on that. We just wasted $15 million or whatever it was," right? So, yeah. So, you know, when we left, we're just kind of like, we're trying to give them Burger King and cable, but they don't want it. I don't know. Maybe they don't. I know. I can't speak for them.
Well, in that story, as I read it, you made a remark that all things in the desert are very quick. But did you find the people also quick?
Yeah. But at the same time, you know, I told you guys that story about Haiti and our culture awareness brief. What we did was a little different. When I first found out that I was going to go to Iraq, I told myself, and I was like, "I'm not going to have any of my guys be that private that I was in Haiti, you know, be all genitalia." First thing I did, that's always good for a laugh, genitalia. The first thing I did is I go down to the bookstore and I bought The Complete Idiot's Guide to the History of Iraq. And I got a lot of crap for it everywhere I went. But after a while, they wanted to know what was in that book. And what we did, Z, remember our study sessions. And we studied the history of the people, the mandate system, and how they just kind of drew lines in the sand, not caring who lived there. We studied their religion, and we learned that in their religion, it's everything in their lives, how they eat their food, you know, how they go to the restroom, and, you know, everything else. It's really very important. And, you know, you go to a shopkeeper and you say, "What time are you going to open your store tomorrow?" "Inshallah." "Well, whenever God wills it to be open, it'll be open," you know. And then we even started to learn their language. And at first I learned Arabic, and I found out, like, after a month of learning it, that I was learning, you know, Egyptian Arabic, which is like speaking Queen's English down in, you know, the South or something, right? So we had to start over. But what I would do is I'd go to the head of the chow line. I'd go to the head of the chow line, and just for my squad at first, I'd say, "What's the phrase of the day?" And if they didn't know it, they had to go to the end of the chow line. And then our platoon sergeant saw me doing that. He's like, "You're doing it for the whole platoon now." And then I was like, pretty soon I was doing it for the whole company, you know? And then when we actually got out there, I mean, it helped incredibly. From when I was in Haiti to when, and even the other units, and I'm not talking bad about any other unit, but when you don't know how to say hello or thank you, and all you do is point a weapon at somebody, I'm going to take that, you know, as like, "You're being a little hostile, you know?" I wouldn't expect them to take it any differently. And so, you know, we spoke to them, and it got to the point where they liked us. They saw our numbers on the trucks, and they're like, "All right, there's, we were 7-4 or 7-3. 7-6, yeah. And they liked us. You know, the guys that blew me up probably didn't like me, but that was in an area that we weren't normally in. We just kind of went to that area for the first time and really didn't have any intel or anything.
You're tuned to Speakers Forum. Our guest tonight is writer, artist, and Iraq War veteran Sean Davis. After this break, The Ultimate Price of War. For KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.
Shot in the hip and left for dead. In come the iron birds from overhead. I overheard that Sharp is dead as night. Looks like rain even when there's sun. Maybe it's just the blood from the wound that fills my face and stains my hands. Is it mine? When we were handsome and brave, staying up all through the night, back to back in a bed of dirt we did lay. To be young and in love, but only make it halfway home. That's what it's like when you've been to hell and back. It's what it's like if you live through hell and back.
Welcome back to the last segment of tonight's Speakers Forum on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. We're listening to a talk by Iraq War veteran Sean Davis. His new book is The Wax Bullet War.
How did writing the book change my understanding? It was, this is the fifth month since it's been out, and I've driven from Portland all the way to Wisconsin, and then I went to Michigan, and then Tennessee, and all over down to San Francisco, and all over. And I thought, like, for sure, this is my roundabout way to answering. When I first got back, I was a wreck. I was horrible because, you know, you live with these guys for a year. I mean, you're with at least 8 guys. You're at the most with 120 guys. And, you know, you can't stand how this one guy always farts and this other guy burps and this other guy snores. And then after I got blown up and sent to Germany, I didn't see anybody. I saw a nurse once every 8 hours to check my vitals. And I was the loneliest person you can ever imagine. I wanted those guys back. And then when I got back, not only did I not have my guys, and I feel like I let them down by leaving, and I feel like I really, you know, had survivor's guilt for Eric getting killed and then me still being alive. Now I also had to deal with the fact that I don't have an identity anymore. I was this super hard-charging, you know, squad leader in the infantry, and now I'm some broke guy, and, you know, they sent me back to Fort Hood, and I just, it wasn't me anymore. And then I also had all of the physical things that come with having your brain amped up on adrenaline for months at a time. And so I did what everybody, well, not everybody, I can't talk for everybody, but for what a lot of us do, when I finally got back to Portland, I isolated myself. I cut all my contacts, and I just self-medicated by drinking all the time. And the VA would give me pills, you know. I was like, I got PTSD, keep it coming, you know. I got pain, keep it coming. I have Vicodin and don't dream medicine and all kinds of stuff, and just drinking myself crazy. And it was like that. And then when these guys finally got back, I'm like, all right, I held it together, they're gonna come back. And what I didn't realize is that they all had the same issues I did, and they all started isolating, and I'm like, they're not back, you know. We're not gonna be a happy family. And it was insane, and I didn't think I was going to ever make it. And I thought about killing myself, and I thought about, wouldn't it have been simple if I had just died, and then whoever would have got $400,000 from the insurance, you know, it would have been better that way. And I tried, and the VA, I'm not going to bang on the VA at all, because in my experience it was pretty good, but it does take a while before it kicks in. And so I didn't have any income for a while, and I was waiting tables at a floating restaurant. And so I had gone from planning and executing combat missions to taking orders for fish and chips and people being, you know, mean to me, and I just not going to take it, you know. I'm freaking out. And one day we had this little fish bowl with lollipops in it, and this before it even opened, and my job was to spray all the goose poop off of the decks and fill this fishbowl full of lollipops, and we're going to start our day. And I spray it all off, and I get this box of lollipops, and I'm going towards this bowl. I'm trying to open it. It's not opening. And I go crazy, and I was like, and I pull it open, and the lollipops are everywhere, and I'm still mad, even though they're everywhere. And I'm stomping all these lollipops, and that's, it was just like the, you know, that scene in the show where like my boss is like, what is going on, man? And so he calls me, you know, he lets me work that whole day. He's trying to figure out what to do, and he tells me like, Sean, you need to talk to somebody, man. I want to help you out, and I know you're a vet, but we can't have that stuff, dude. And so I decided to go to help. And help at the time was called the Mental Hygiene Clinic. And I don't know about you, but I wouldn't want to go to a mental hygiene clinic. So they're going to saw off the top of my head and take a, you know, sanitary wipe. And it was really horrible. And the lady that I saw was not a veteran. And she was horribly, horribly overweight. And I'm like, yeah, you got problems. And I freaked out again. And it was mean, but, I left and, finally, and I knew it, you know, I just kept thinking like, what do? You either sit around drinking all the time and, you know, think about suicide. You can't do that. You got to either do it or go get help. And I went to the place, another place called the Vet Center, a veteran center outside of Portland. And it was a staff full of veterans, and they kind of knew what I was talking about. But the therapy, sitting down talking, doesn't really help me. And Linda, the veteran I was talking to, whatever her title was, she said, well, what did you want to do? I'm like, I wanted to be an artist when I grew up. She's like, do some art. And I'm like, wow, that was really, really easy for you, you know? And so I went home and started painting. And it was something that I was like, wow, this is working. And I'm painting. And then I'm like, I want to write too. And then I started writing. I wrote The Kid. And at first I wrote it in third person because I still needed that barrier. I didn't want to put, I did this. I want to put, he did this. And I did it, and it worked. And it went from there. And then the VA did kick in, and it helped me. And it said, hey, we're going to put you through college. And I, 5 years later, I had my master's degree. And I'm like, I'm doing this. I'm going to treat it like a mission, you know. And then after that, during my grad school, one of my, the coolest dude in the world, he's my faculty, he's my mentor, Mike Magnuson. He's a writer, a bunch of books published. And he said, you know, he's kind of that, I love the blunt, honest guys. He's from Wisconsin, and he's just like a bulldozer. He's like, yeah, you got to put all this stuff together, and then you're going to start at 9/11, you're going to end at Katrina, and that's going to be your book, and you're going to get it published. I'm like, whoa, all right, my next mission. And I did it, you know, and it happened. But I was lucky with the people that I met, but you have to still be on the right mission, you know, I think. And so now we're talking about the opera and painting and stuff. I hang my art at the Six Days Gallery in the Alberta Arts District in Portland. I help out. I'm producing an opera right now. I got a bunch of combat veterans as extras in an opera, which was a really surreal experience. That the casting call is on Tuesday, and it was fun. And then I do one act plays, and the veterans write them, they direct them, they star in them, and it's on cable access in Portland. And again, you know, I'm dealing. At first, I was trying to help people from our unit, you know, that were in Portland too. And they're like, I would literally get calls like, Sean, I'm thinking about killing myself tonight. I don't know what to do, you know? And I'm like, oh man, you know, it's a lot of pressure on me. I barely got myself together. But nowadays, you know, working with them, now other people know that I've been working in especially the Portland community, and they come to me, you know? And I'm like, I just moved to Portland. I flew jets in the Marines, you know, and what do I do? And I get them to do these things, and they tell me, it's like, I've been in some, this is what I heard just Monday. It's like, I've been in some really dark places this month, and that table read that we did was the first fun that I've had in a long time, you know. And what it does, the art, and like, I don't know, everybody's going to be in opera, but the art and the stage plays and everything else, if you do that as a veteran, you start telling people about it. Like, you're not going to believe what I just did. And that is a connection. That one connection that you had severed before, you're making those connections again. And the more connections that you have with your loved ones and the community around you, the less likely you are to do anything stupid, like, you know, drink until you black out or even kill yourself. Because the last numbers that they have in 2010, we're losing a guy, 22 guys a day? That's insane. And I'm sure that it's more now, you know. And I've been there because there's nothing for me in this world. I was awesome. I was a god among men. And now who am I? I'm nothing. I'm weak and I can't figure out what I'm going to do with my life. And it's horrible. It's horrible. But they can, you know. And that's why I hate that veteran as a victim mentality. And they can get through it. They can get through it. Me, I help people. And honestly, I mean, I have 3 readings this week. I had art therapy last Saturday with veterans. This Saturday, I speak at a gala downtown for the opera. I just did the casting call, and I'm also doing the stage play. So I keep myself busy with that, and that's what helps me. When people ask me, like, what I can do, what can I do to help out a veteran that I know needs help, and I tell them, you ask them to do something for you, because they're very mission-oriented, you know, and, like, they want to do stuff. Even if they don't know it, you know, they'll, like, all right, I'll do this for you. Like, come over and help me paint my house. I know I'm sorry, it's a pain, but do this, you know, and it gives them a mission, you know. And also make those connections again. I don't know. Don't coddle any of them at all. They're going to hate you for it, I promise. All right. I'm going to tell this story. I was going to read it, but I'll tell this story. So it was, I don't know, a couple months in, maybe 3 months in, then Iraq was holding their first elections. And they did it in the agricultural building. And they did that because we had bombed every other official-looking building in the city, right? So they had their elections in the agricultural building. And they sent us out to go sweep around it to make sure there was nobody there. And what they did, they said, movement to contact. You know, you see anybody in there, especially with weapons, you kill them, you know? Because what they're afraid of is that these guys are going to set up mortar tubes and blow up the agriculture building. And all the guys that were finally said, hey, I want to lead the country, are dead now. It would really throw us back. So they drop us off at 2 o'clock in the morning in the zoo, you know, in like Disneyland, their Disneyland type of thing. And yeah, and that was another one of those ironies, armed men walking through Disneyland ready to kill people. And we're walking, we have our nods on, our night vision devices. They drop us off at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. We're walking around, we're walking through the parade field where the two cross sabers are, where Saddam raised his shotgun and all that stuff. And around, I don't know, almost 4 o'clock, the first light they have called a prayer. So you have that nasally singing going on everywhere. And at this time, you can't see through your night vision. You have to flip them up. But you can't really see without them either. So you can't really see too much. And we're walking through this playground. We get through the playground. And we see this hill. And beyond this hill, there's this kind of fire dancing. So I'm like, man, there's people up there. So we crawl up on this hill. We set up. We have our machine guns on the side, you know, to intersect and lock interlocking sectors of fire. And we get up there, and the whole squad's set up. We see these 5 guys with AK-47s, you know, and I'm thinking, like, we're going to have to kill these guys. These guys are smoked. And we're just about to do it, but I noticed that they all had shirts and pants on, that they all matched shirt and pants, blue shirts and black pants or whatever. And which was funny because the uniform, the enemy over there doesn't wear uniforms. So we're like, okay, something's going on. And so like, all right, Z, let's go talk to these guys. And so we're walking down this hill, the most vulnerable I've ever felt in my life, you know. And these guys, there's one guy is squatting over a little campfire. They got 3 weapons stacked over here, so they kind of sit up without being on the ground. And we have 2 guys over here smoking and joking. And we walk down. And as soon as they see us, they all go for their weapons. And I'm like, these guys are dead. We're going to smoke them, you know. And I'm like, Augoff. And just like a miracle, they stop. And I'm like, what? And what it was is they were zoo security, and they were out there trying to help us out. And the only reason they're going for their weapons is because they didn't want us to think that they're being lazy. They want to be like us, you know. And we went from killing everybody there to having tea with them in 5 minutes. And it was, and again, you know, that language, the culture, you know, and that's what, and that adrenaline, you know, after you don't know what to do with it because you got it all in you and you want to do something and you don't. And so what you do is you tell a dumb joke and you laugh for 10 minutes and then you go to sleep on top of a museum is what we did. But we took turns sleeping. But yeah, that day there was car bombs all around us, and we ended up on top of this zoo building we called the Playboy Mansion. And we watched these Kiowas, these little helicopters, dance around on top of the water and stuff. It was pretty, but it was crazy. I got one more, and it'll be sad, but then if you guys can ask some questions, we won't end on a sad note. So it's really up to you. All right. Yeah, this was a tough one to read, so I might get choked up a little bit, but, you know, I'm a tough guy, so you guys don't worry about that. This was after I got blown up on June 13th, 2004. And they blew us up with an IED in the car, spun us around. I woke up with my head on his lap, and they're shooting at us. The ground was just exploding. At first, I didn't know what the hell was going on. These rocks were going everywhere. And I look, and I'm like, Z, you pulled me out of the wrong side, man, because they spun us around, and the triggermen were over here. And so we get up, and I try to get up, and my leg is broken, and so he just grabs me by my harness. He's dragging me, and I'm trying to shoot. I don't know what the hell's going on. And then the other guys come back. Our buddy Shane runs towards us to try to help me with an A-bag. Another explosion goes off, and he just got shot like 20, 30 feet. I thought he was dead. I didn't see it all the way because he covered me with his body. Yeah, that's how he got some shrapnel. And then they started mortaring us, and it was horrible. Finally, when the mortaring stopped, the helicopter landed, and they loaded me up, and we went to Baghdad. And this is my first memories of the Baghdad Combat Army Surgical Hospital. They hurried me into a room with more light than I imagined heaven would have. And I felt each wobble of the gurney wheels in the fault lines of my broken bones. And I stared up at the unbearable white, letting it bleach my vision, hoping that it would take my mind off the pain. I'd lost too much blood. I had fractures, shrapnel, wounds, breaks, and burns. But my wrist had been so badly damaged that it needed most of the attention. The silhouette of a surgeon's head shadowed me for a second, while some assistant put a mask over my mouth and nose and swung my arm out on the right wing of a stainless steel table until it locked perpendicular to my body. And I lay half crucified, and finally the anger set in. It washed over me as I considered the fact that I had no idea what I might die for. And time stretched and bunched and flowed and stalled to the unpredictable rhythm of a morphine drip. And I woke again, not knowing how long I had been out. And a single thought shook me. My eyes shot open. I looked down, and I was relieved to find all four fingers and a thumb sticking out of the cast of my right forearm. They were discolored and swollen and the size of sausages, but all of them were there. And wires and tubes and shiny metal rods stuck out of the bleached white sheets of my bed. Machines surrounded me, and beeping and humming. And there was a low, muffled sound of the air being released. The room was beige with chipped paint in the corners, but other than that, it was a hospital room like I'd seen anywhere else. Small, no windows, white tiled floor. Before I was completely awake, a pretty half Asian nurse walked in and stretched on her tiptoes to change my IV. She smiled down at me like an angel. "Are you awake? Are you in pain?" And her words and smile were so full of pity and pride. Everything ached, but I can feel the medicine had dulled it. "I'm okay." And I saw my boots, my flak vest, and my helmet in a pile in the corner of the room. She saw me looking at them. "We had to cut your uniform off and dispose of it, but we saved those." And I stared at that pile so long my eyes lost focus. And after a few minutes, she asked, "Would you like to use a phone to call home?" home. The word broke my trance. A phone? Yes, maybe you'd like to call a loved one. I nodded. She left the room for a minute and came back with a big black cell phone in one hand and a plastic bedpan in the other. Do you need to relieve yourself before you call? Relieve yourself. She let the words roll off her tongue like it was the most natural thing in the world. She was really asking if I had to take a shit, because if I did, it would be a two-person operation. And there was no getting out of that bed with all the monitors and machines and braces. And blood rushed to my face. She must have seen it because she started talking fast about nothing, as if a constant flow of words can stop the embarrassment. And the drugs she gave me for the pain usually caused constipation, but sometimes they took a while, she told me. And she added that it was all part of her job, and she did this all the time. It really wasn't an issue. I shouldn't feel bad about it. But the tears came, and I hated myself for crying. I tried to hold it back, but I couldn't. The whole situation seemed so stupid, and there was really no reason for me to bawl like a baby, but I had this flash of anger with no way to do anything about it. Hours before, I was planning and executing combat missions. I'd led men. I'd had the power over life and death, and now I couldn't even by myself. And I turned my head and I stared at the pile in the corner while the nurse slid the bedpan under the covers. She told me about the success of the operation on my arm and how it was a testament to the world-class talent in the Armed Forces combat surgical teams. And the pile of the equipment in the corner looked as if the soldier wearing it had suddenly disappeared, letting it all just fall to the floor, the boots, the flak vests, the helmet on top. And she told me that not many surgical teams in any hospital anywhere could have been able to save my hand. And I felt so unnatural moving my bowels in bed, and I can smell the shit. And the boots had the laces cut out, the helmet had black carbon stains on its side, and the flak vest had small shrapnel holes running up the back. And the rods sticking out of my arm were there to ensure the bone healed correctly, she said. It had been splintered, so they screwed a piece of metal along the radial, above and below the fracture. I'm done, I said so quietly that there was no way anyone could have heard me, so I repeated it louder. I'm done. The wipes she used were warm, and I appreciated that. That wasn't so hard. I don't think we'll have to do that again. Don't worry, she said. And before she left the room, she gave me the phone, and I held it to my left hand for a while, thinking about who I should call. Then I realized I didn't know anybody's number by heart except for my little brother. And after a few minutes, I pushed Vince's number into the phone, and there were a couple clicks and a hushed static before a constant clicking, which must have been subtle, a substitute for the ring. And on the third ring, Vince picked up, and I can tell that I woke him. Hello? Vince. And it was all I can get out. I hadn't thought about what I was going to say. And finally, I said, I told you they couldn't kill me, I said, and I laughed, and I mustered up as much bravado as I could. What? He turned very serious. They blew me up, and they shot at me, and they even mortared me. My truck was blown up, and a friend of mine. And my voice cracked at the word friend. And I had to stop for a moment. And when I continued, my voice was lower and grave. There was an ambush. My friend Eric was killed instantly. I was hurt. Are you okay? The fear in his voice put a lump in my throat. I'm fine. A couple broken bones. I'll call again later. Tell Mom and Dad that I'm okay. I gotta go. And I hung up before he can say anything else. And I closed my eyes and pressed the phone against my forehead. I told you that was a downer. Sorry. But after that, I spent a couple days in Germany. And Shane was there in Germany too. And Shane had his shoulder blade blown out, and they had to put a fake one in. But for a while, he had a big hole. But there was nothing wrong with his legs, right? So I'd be laying in bed with the whole right side of my body just broken and bruised, and I'd see Shane pushing his little IV cart down this way. And then I'd see two hot nurses chasing him. And And like 2 minutes later, two hot nurses going this way, and then Shane chasing them. It was like a Scooby-Doo cartoon. It was great. And then I don't know if you guys know this, but in Germany, there's a woman whose only job is to buy injured soldiers' clothes. You get $140, and she said, comes in, she's like, what do you want to buy? I'm like, I don't know, whatever, doesn't care. She's like, what style do you want? I'm like, I just don't care about any of this. But she got me clothes. But for a while in Germany, I was there by myself, and I didn't know, you know, I thought I was in trouble or I was under quarantine because nobody came in. And what it was is I had this little joke that I played. Whenever I got a new pair of dog tags, I'd choose a new religion. You know, I was trying to cover the bases. And I think when I got hit, I was voodoo and Wiccan. I still have those. And so none of the chaplains knew what the hell to do. Finally, it was a Jewish chaplain came in and he told me, he's like, yeah, none of the other chaplains think you really take this too serious, but I thought you maybe want to talk. And I love that guy for that because I did want to talk. And then after Germany, they sent me to Fort Hood, Texas, and I stayed there for a couple months. And the funny thing about Fort Hood, Texas, first off, they put me on the third floor of the barracks, and I had a broken leg, so it took me a half hour to get up to the top. Secondly, they sent me with a bunch of guys that were either hurt or they faked injuries and illnesses not to go to war, and so that was horrible. I had a bad attitude. And thirdly, you know, so at this point, you know, I'm like, this sucks. Everything sucks. They're giving me pain pills. I'm just going to get drunk. And so I'm just like down in Vicodin and red wine and beer and shots, whatever. So one day, like 9 o'clock in the morning, I'm drunk on duty. I barely have half my uniform on. It's just like boom, boom, boom at my door. And I'm like, this is it. I don't care. I'm going to jail, whatever. And I opened the door and there was criminal detective, it was CID, it was an MP detective, a military detective. And I'm like, okay, you know, put him on, whatever. And he's like, no, you got to come to the station when we get ready. So I get ready, go down to the station, and he sits me down at his desk, and he says, I'm working an attempted murder case. And I'm like, okay, why do you need me? It's like, well, because the guys that tried to kill you didn't kill you, or it's attempted murder. I'm like, what? He's like, the guys in Iraq that tried to kill me are working the case? I'm like, do you solve many of these cases? And I just went along with it. He's like, what did the guy look like? I'm like, well, he's about 5'5", black hair, mustache, you know, wearing a long flowing gown. I don't know. And what happened, you know, I was talking, and what happened was they weren't sure if they were going to call it a war or not because Bush had said mission accomplished. And so it was after this, and like, are we still at war or what? And if we're not at war, then we have to try these cases. And whatever. I don't think they found the guys. All right. But honestly, I'm not mad at them. I don't think that they did anything wrong that I wouldn't have done if I was over there. You know, we went through people's houses, and I'm not saying what we did was wrong either. I'm just saying I don't understand any of it, honestly. But there I was. You guys got any other questions before I?
I read about your interview with 60 Minutes, and yeah. I just wonder, in today's environment, would that interview still be conducted?
I don't know if it would be conducted today, but what you guys, if you haven't read it, Steve Croft kept asking me over and over again. Well, I'm in this interview. He's at where I live, and he says, if you guys had up armored Humvees, would Eric still be alive? And that's not a fair question to ask. You know, that's not cool. And I said, I don't. You know, and at this point, I'm like, I'm not going to rat out my guys. I don't know the command. I don't know the situation, so I'm not going to answer this question. I'm like, I don't know. So he's like, okay. And we're talking about other things. And like, he's really friendly, really friendly. Like, we're buddies. And then he asked the question again. It's like, if you guys had up armored Humvees, would Eric still be alive? And I'm like, at this point, I'm like, I don't want to disappoint my new friend, but I'm not going to, you know, I've already answered this question. And so I tell him the same thing. And again, you know, he skips it. And he looks at the producer and I can say, like, I've disappointed him, you know. And we're talking for another 10 minutes. And he asked me again if, you know, yet up Armored Humvees? Would Eric still be alive? And I'm like, fine, I'm not going to answer that question. I'm sorry. You want to go to the next one, and we're still buddies. But I don't know. I mean, I don't know if he's head hunting or he's looking for something to talk about. The truth is, we should have had up Armored Humvees, but I don't know with that explosion if, you know, it was pretty bad. So I don't know if we would have lived through it anyway. So what are my views of owning guns or veterans having guns? I think if a veteran is having difficulties in thinking about suicide, they shouldn't have weapons in their house. As far as the Second Amendment goes, you know, I've always believed in the Constitution. I don't know. I mean, I wrote an article about this called Jesus Gave Me an A-Bomb. And it was, the argument was, if the Second Amendment means that we have guns because we're supposed to be able to overthrow our government if they become tyrants, then we all better get some A-bombs because they have them already, you know, and it's not going to be you charging with your hunting rifle, you know. So, I don't know. I'm not sure about the answer. Do I own any? I have my lieutenant from Iraq gave me an M4 just like I carried in Iraq. I have that. I go out and shoot every once in a while. I have a 9mm Beretta, but I think that they should be registered like cars are registered. You know, I don't think that takes away from our rights, but that's just me. I don't know the answers. Z, what do you think about? Well, they're still in, so they just came from Fort Lewis to razz me, and I thought you guys were gonna like throw some insults a lot more than you did.
I own guns. I don't see the real issue with it. I agree with you. You know, when it comes to something like that. I guess you're talking about like your psyche and people that have psychological issues. I mean, obviously, like suicide.
Yeah, it was a huge tragedy when Super Sniper got killed.
Like, you know, if you're in that state of mind, it's like if you don't have that, you have something else. You're not going to shoot yourself. You're not jumping off a bridge or driving your car into a tree off the bank.
Yeah, I didn't have any weapons when I was in that period, but I did think about crashing a car, and I owned a car, and I didn't do it. I would live right next to a river with lots of bridges. I didn't jump off any of them. But at the same time, I don't know, the temptation's right there. Because I do know guys that had weapons and were in that boat, and it was a pretty close call. And I would like to avoid it all, honestly.
Can I ask another controversial question?
Yeah, I love controversial questions. Oh, death with dignity for vets coming back from war with TBI. Yeah, I'm so happy that they passed that bill, giving an extra $17 billion to veterans with TBI in assisted living facilities so they don't get them out of there. As far as, I don't know, my own views, I would say that I would hate to be in that situation and unplug me, but at the same time, at this point, I love life so much that I want to stay on for every second. You know, I don't know. It's a hard thing. I'm not sure. That's tough. That is really, I feel like asking you a bad question. I guess, and if I'm there and I'm feeling so much pain, I don't know, maybe I'd be different, but at this point I would like to hold on until at least they can plug me into a computer or something. I don't know, whatever that is. So, right on. Well, I really appreciate your guys' time. Thank you so much for coming out here. Well, I'm sorry, Ryan, did you have something? All right. Thank you so much.
Sean Davis is a writer, artist, teacher, and Iraq War veteran. Of his military service, he wrote, "The combat I lived through is an echo that never goes away. And when I first came home, that echo was so loud I could barely hear anything else. Art is what helped me through it." In addition to his teaching, writing, and painting, Davis is the Veterans Service Coordinator for Portland, Oregon's Anima Mundi Productions, a nonprofit arts initiative. Davis's new book is The Wax Bullet War, Chronicles of a Soldier and Artist. He spoke at Ravenna's Third Place Books on August 6th, 2014. Thanks again to Anna Tatashev for this recording. If you enjoyed tonight's talk, you'll find an extended version and others to choose from on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Thanks for listening tonight. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.